peacemaking, justice making, and then how to go about talking to other people. So, let's think of some way, some things that we can do. Your suggestions. What's going to be helpful?
Inform ourselves.
Okay.
Read.
What do we read?
Journals and newspapers.
Some dudes.
Mm-hmm. Other specific suggestion?
Pray about peace.
Oh, just other specific journals or
the other side.
Can you read this at all?
Fellowship magazine.
Okay. What is Fellowship?
It's the quarterly Fellowship of Reconciliation magazine.
And what's Fellowship of Reconciliation?
It's a national peace organization founded in 1914 to promote nonviolent resistance.
That's the oldest and largest pacifist organization in the States.
Headquarters where?
Nyack, New York. Does it only come out quarterly now? It used to be monthly when I took it, but a few years ago
it
stopped.
The thing is, I haven't gotten it. I don't really
All right. Okay. Pray.
I would include listening to others.
Okay.
And that includes people like in a lecture setting or just a one-on-one with people who agree and or disagree.
Okay.
Join support groups.
Okay. Anybody want to say any more about this? Ever try to be very active and quote peacemaking things without being in a support group? It's a prescription for emotional disaster. You start to feel like you are out of your mind. Since everyone else tells you that.
So if there isn't a support group, trying to get one organized, I suppose you'd be there.
Congregation, or the LPF chapter?
We had, in our congregation, we had what came to be known as the Peacemaking Committee. There's never more than about 12 people in a congregation of 650, but very active people and very vocal and very visible as far as what came out of that committee, and the whole congregation got known sort of as this peace congregation in the community and everything. And I think most people in the congregation thought there were 50 or 100 people in this committee, and it was really, I think, an instance of leaven in this big loaf, because it was just this tiny, tiny group. But it was certainly helpful to have 8 people instead of 1 person.
I suppose the first thing is to, if there isn't a support group, to get a study group, to get people together who are willing to at least be open to studying and learning.
There's a lot of resources available, films and speaker lists and books that come out of some of those organizations. And there's lists in back this book.
Is that the Cider book?
Uh-huh. There are today millions and millions and millions of resources, which is wonderful. 10 years ago, you could easily keep up with what was going on in peacemaking publishing. A couple books a year.
Lifestyle?
Say some more.
Well, peacemaking encompassing justice. Peacemaking without recognition of justice, and the idea that justice comes from one's attitude, how they live, and that attitude in relationship to those people that are oppressed. You know, the recognition of how do I live, and my actions affects people that are.
Senator Mark Hatfield and lots of other people have said the biggest threat to peace is hunger. And so we certainly need to look at that whole. I mean, the more you look, the more everything is tied together.
I guess, I don't know if this comes into lifestyle or not, but we need to remember to start in our own immediate relationships too with peacemaking, family, and. Okay. Resistance is legal.
Well, I think organized picket.
Okay. Demonstration.
Letter writing.
Letter writing. It was to be discussed at the meeting between National Council of Church Leaders and Russian Orthodox leaders last October. And I haven't heard what's come out of it. There have been literally thousands of requests from U.S. churches to do that. And at the moment, the Orthodox Church, which is the prime church, their primary church, doesn't have the bureaucratic staff, etc., to deal with the requests. Preparing, but they're hoping to get that set up. I would expect to see that sometime in the next year. But there's been very, very much interest from the United States, which is gratifying. Did everybody get one of these sheets? All right, travel to other countries, I think maybe the only other one that's on here. Oh, influence public education. We had primarily one woman in our congregation that was really excited about working through the school system and sat down with the assistant superintendent of schools two, three, four times, talked about global education, and finally worked to get that, got that in the curriculum in our school district in Stillwater. They had a all-day teacher in service on global education, and I think that's real helpful way to go, teaching our children that there is life outside of U.S. boundaries. And there's quite a bit of good curricula available. In some school districts, there's also quite a bit of resistance to that, very organized resistance from groups that really want to emphasize America first, America only. Why bother learning about these other lands? Listed some journals here. Perhaps the single most useful one that I've found is the Defense Monitor, and has lots of credibility given who puts it out. It's virtually all retired military people. Not pacifist by any means, but feeling that even wanting a strong defense, we're really acting foolishly. And I'm sorry, I don't have the address for Coalition for a New Foreign and Military Policy. I have it in my room. When I was typing this up, I realized I didn't have it. But if anyone's interested in that, they could see me. That comes. They have a newsletter that comes out often. It's hard for me even to keep up with reading it. It's about every 2 weeks and gives all the legislation that's currently up, which is real helpful for voting. And the coalition is primarily religious groups, or at least like the Peace and Justice Committees of various denominations and stuff. It's a big coalition, probably 30, 40 different groups. One thing that I do quite a bit is to give subscriptions of Sojourners to people who are new Christians and to people who are just newly interested in the issue of peacemaking or things like that. Just kind of saying, wow, this is kind of new stuff and I'd like to hear more. For those who are coming from a Christian base, I think it's a good way to go. And the gift subscriptions are only $12 a year. So if you want to save money, you give somebody a $12 gift subscription, and they give you one, and you save $3. Yeah. Out of your sense of guilt, then you give them $10, and you're out $7. Okay, anything else? I'm probably not as diligent as I used to be, but I really find that prayer is really helpful for me personally, emotionally. Probably the single most important thing that we can be about. I don't recall if I mentioned this in the whole group. I talked about it yesterday with just a couple of people afterwards, that I really think that today is the most exciting time in history to be alive. That our technology has forced us to make some fundamental alterations in the way people get along with each other, particularly nation states. that we have two choices left. We're either going to end it all or we're going to begin it all in a fresh way. My hope, certainly, of course, not necessarily my optimism, but hope is that in 100 years people will look back at war the way we look at slavery. I'm sometimes grateful to be alive in the 1980s and to see what's going on and to try to have some part in that. Another sense of me from a Christian perspective is that God is going to bring in this kingdom, this realm, if you will, regardless of me. That it's not up to me, but that God would like to have me get on board and get with the program rather than getting in the way. And that helps me feel a little more hopeful also. A couple more signs of hope. See, you know, I don't know if this will strike you the way it struck me. I'm going to excerpt a few paragraphs out of the latest newsletter from the Center for Global Service and Education, which sponsored the trip that Dan and Carmen were on and that I was on, Central America. This is an article by Marilyn McDiarmid, who is a Quaker, went on an Oxfam study trip to Sri Lanka, where the Dimmicks had just come from, for those of you who were here in November, I guess, when they were here. And she's writing about Sarvodaya, I don't know if that's how it's pronounced, that's what it looks like, which is a self-development movement in Sri Lanka. It signifies the awakening or liberation of one and all. The movement's saying is, may all beings be well and happy. It reflects a Buddhist wish for welfare for all of the people. Believing national development should begin with the villages, the movement helps people organize themselves to deal directly with their own problems. Since 1958, Sarvodaya has become active in about 30% of the 23,000 villages on the island, with programs in health, education, agricultural, and local industry. An estimated 2.5 to 3 million islanders have experienced the impact of this movement. The Sarvodayan philosophy is carried out in the days of Shramadana. Shrama means labor, and dana means to give. Today, a Shramadana, a sharing of labor, would find villagers and the six Americans of the study tour group transforming development philosophy into human reality, work. We gathered in front of the village shrine where their Lord Buddha smiled benevolently. Removing our thongs, we formed a large circle inside the sacred ground area. Short prayers were said for the coming workday, and a prayer flag, Buddhist flag, and Sarvodaya banner were raised onto bamboo poles. As a group, we now headed for the trail encircling the 2,000-year-old tank, a water reservoir the size of a large lake, which was built by ancient kingdoms for irrigation and water supply. Rapid jungle growth demanded continuous clearing if there was to be access to the tank. The tank is the center for many activities vital to village life, including clothes washing, bathing, harvesting of lotus flowers for food and offerings to the Buddha shrines, and collecting cooking and drinking water. The Shramadana had been decided earlier in the week at a village meeting. When a village requests assistance from Sarvodaya, villagers are instructed in how to organize the village internally so all can participate in the decision-making. All villagers are invited to attend the meetings. This group then becomes the primary planning body for identifying village problems and developing solutions. The meeting had been held under shade trees in the center of the village. Women sat on one side and men on the other. The village monk sat in the only chair, facing the people. He was a startling figure with his brilliant tangerine-orange sarong and shaven head. His presence was a reminder to adhere to spiritual principles during the discussion and decision-making process. The women were active and respected participants in the meeting. At first, many of the men wanted only to clear the tank trail. However, the female teacher spoke vigorously and relentlessly for the schoolyard to be cleared also. Another woman wept while pleading for a fence to be mended that would keep the cows from wandering into her chili field and trampling the plants. It was an energetic discussion, almost heated at times. Then everyone grew silent. Consensus came quietly and quickly. A committee would be dispatched to see to the cow problem. The morning would be spent clearing the tank trail, the afternoon given to the schoolyard. Amazing! Was I in Katamurachana or back home at a Quaker business meeting? These third world rural villagers had just held a meeting with everyone participating, had come to consensus instead of voting, and made use of silence to find the sense of the meeting. Community self-reliance was evident in this Shramadana. Villagers had seen the problem of trail overgrowth and proceeded to clear their own access trails. The Sarvodaya message to uneducated, isolated, poor villagers is, you have the abilities and intelligence to meet your own needs according to your wishes and priorities. Gather together, identify the problems, decide collectively the resolutions, and act together to accomplish your goals. The similarity between this Buddhist-based development program message and the message of Christian-based communities in Latin America is striking. Both speak out to the immediate condition of the people and support self-efforts to effect change. Could it be that the universal spirit is passing the word along to poor and oppressed people throughout the world that their time is now and that they deserve lives of well-being and self-respect? I think we may learn, I hope, from what we call third world countries. How many of you are familiar with the hundredth monkey phenomenon? The Japanese monkey, Macaca fuscata, has been observed in the wild for a period of over 30 years. In 1952, on the island of Koshima, scientists were providing monkeys with sweet potatoes dropped in the sand. The monkeys liked the taste of the raw sweet potatoes, but they found the dirt unpleasant. An 18-month-old female named Imo found she could solve the problem by washing the potatoes in a nearby stream. She taught this trick to her mother. Her playmates also learned this new way, and they taught their mothers too. This cultural innovation was gradually picked up by various monkeys before the eyes of the scientists. Between 1952 and 1958, all the young monkeys learned to wash the sandy sweet potatoes to make them more palatable. Only the adults who imitated their children learned this social improvement. Other adults kept eating the dirty sweet potatoes. Then something startling took place. In the autumn of 1958, a certain number of Koshima monkeys were washing sweet potatoes. The exact number of monkeys is not known. Let us suppose that when the sun rose one morning, there were 99 monkeys on Koshima Island who had learned to wash their sweet potatoes. Let's further suppose that later that morning, the 100th monkey learned to wash potatoes. Then it happened. By that evening, almost everyone in the tribe was washing sweet potatoes before eating them. The added energy of this 100th monkey... Okay, let's then look at how do we go about this part, listening and talking to other people. About justice issues, about peacemaking, which is the same thing, really. As far as we did it, how should we not go about it? Enlisted some, absurd things like, you don't clobber people over the head.
Paralysis of analysis.
Okay.
Getting really bogged down with not knowing anything.
So what's the alternative?
I'd say talking with others, to look for a commonality between yourself and that other person.
Okay.
You have to find out how much they know, even, about numbers and whatnot.
Or I would suggest common fears or common hopes. Because, as is often said, at least I've never run into anyone really in favor of war or nuclear war. I think there are a few such people around. I've never run into that's never been the issue. The issue when I've been in is there's always how do you prevent it. So you can start from, you're scared of being taken over, or you're scared of you know, being annihilated, so am I. You know, you want to get along with other countries, so do I. How do then, you know, then the question is, how do we get there? And the listening, to try to see what the real issues are for people. There was a man in our congregation that was, the first time I preached a sermon on peacemaking, and it's not the way I'd go about it today. I was about 8 months out of seminary, and I just really laid it on the line. And he was really, really upset. He'd been one of my pretty good friends to that point. And I finally, he stayed in the church by the skin of his teeth and by a lot of pleading and things. And over the next 6 years, we spent a lot of time with each other, you know, going out to lunch together and talking about things. And it took me a long time to realize where he was coming from, having served in Vietnam. And he never came right out, but my guess is that he had killed people. And for his pastor to say that wasn't okay was real, real threatening for him.
Talking about Vietnam, but also, you know, when I talk to my dad's friends, I have no idea what war is about. And it's kind of offensive if you just kind of tell them, well, I'm a person of peace and go on and on about your why you're involved in peace movement. And you know, World War II still so prideful for that generation that there's got to be a lot of listening and respect for their, because obviously I'm young, I arrogant young punk is going to tell them how to. Respectfully listen and understand their story.
Mm-hmm. Their standpoint, listen to their story.
Yeah. This is kind of crass sometimes, but another thing that gives me hope is that the World War II generation is dying off. And I mean that real seriously. I think that I've run into so many people who think we're going to fight World War II again. And probably we're not going to. We're going to fight something either much smaller scale or infinitely larger scale. And the people who think we're going to go in there with tanks are dangerous, I feel. So that's where I think some of the statistics or charts can be helpful. You know, especially like the chart that Dan has in the back of his book about, you know, those little dots comparing World War II to comparing the arsenals of today. I mean, good heavens.
There's one thing about the older generation, they won't go to fight this time.
That's right. That's right. And certainly I'm not saying the older generation all thinks that way. I've run into some, you know, World War II vets who are just the most active peace people now saying, I'm not a pacifist, I was proud to fight there, but holy cow. You know, look at what we're doing today. Like the people at Center for Defense Information. Talking about apples and oranges, we're talking about apples and atomic weapons.
Talking about issues that are, you know, related to peacemaking, but perhaps an individual might not make that connection. I'm just talking about justice, in a broad sense. If you just start talking about justice not connected with peace, and then as I suppose that might relate to looking for commonality, but sort of, if need be, suddenly then transfer that discussion.
Is that the New Testament supports military policy?
Yeah, I guess I remember that a little bit.
What's that?
That was a couple of weeks ago. He used the story for Jesus' parable about Reagan. The person being diligent. Watching so someone stronger doesn't come and rob your house.
Oh.
And I've heard it said Jesus supports his military policy. This had to be the very depths of
Yeah, I just tuned into this press conference where somebody asked about that. And he said, yes, I've had checked it out with a number of pastors and theologians who have supported my use of that. I didn't know what he was referring to at the time. Well, okay.
But outside of Reagan, have you heard anybody
that? Reagan probably gets that from the churches that he attends. Presbyterian churches, both in California and in Washington, D.C. Much to my pride. More presidents have been Presbyterian than any other
denomination. Well, they cover the fact he doesn't go very often.
He doesn't go very often.
The whole picture here.
Remember, enemies is a
yeah. And Reagan is not a member of a Presbyterian church. I think their membership is still in a Methodist or something like that, but they, when they do occasionally go to the Presbyterian church. And Eisenhower was Presbyterian, and the author of the famous quote, I don't really think it's important what people believe just so they believe something. Now that's civil religion at its best. So, okay. Others? Let me, I don't want to downplay statistics and quote facts entirely. Ones that I found helpful are, in that packet of miscellaneous stuff in there, there's about a four-page newsletter-type thing, and probably several copies of it, on the nuclear weapons freeze. And in there are the quotes from, I believe I mentioned the other day, from Joint Chiefs of Staff and the head of the Army, the head of the Air Force and everything, before Congress, being asked, would you trade the U.S. Army for the Soviet Army? No. Would you trade the U.S. Air Force for the Soviet Air Force? No. Would you trade, finally, John Vesey, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, was asked, would you trade overall Soviet military capability, ours versus the Soviet military capability? No. So I think that's the answer from the horse's mouth to whether or not we're behind. In fact, we're not. Just a few things like that. That are helpful, at least I find helpful, in discussions. You know, you don't need all those statistics, but I also find it helpful to have some.
And some people, if you're talking about support groups or groups in a congregation, some people are just drawn to figures and data like that, and they're gifted that way. And if they get involved with peace movement, they're really helpful because they can. Of course, you have the emotional side of it, and that's the key, of course. But you're talking rational versus irrational. Our Christian faith is irrational to begin with, so. In a way, intangible, but yet to communicate with the other side, you have to have some kind of ground figures and data. I don't find that's where my gift is at all. I skip over all those charts and books.
In the fall, about the two student speakers that you heard someplace. And the young man gave a very fine analysis and everything.
Mm-hmm. It was in Seattle at the Barman Conference where two college students gave speeches on the nuclear arms race. And the first speaker was a male college, very kind of cocky sophomore, and he had this wonderful speech, very articulate. I forgot what he said, I just remember it was very articulate. Somewhat, very rational, very reasonable. I didn't forget what said it was. Then the second speaker was a woman, and she got into her third sentence and broke down crying at the podium, and then just sobbed and finally apologized and said, I just can't finish my speech, the subject hurts me too much, and sat down, and she felt devastated. And afterwards, we went up and told her that hers was probably the only appropriate response that there is to the nuclear arms race. That if you know what it is, that probably is the only appropriate response.
I would think one of the most effective ways you could relate to someone would be if you have the experience to do or to share something like you did when you were talking about the people that you kind of contact with in the Soviet Union. And try to approach it on you.
About our Christian faith, don't you believe that
well, to me, loving your neighbor is so basic that you don't even have to really believe in God to really love your neighbor, and that's something that I find useful when I talk to people. Just the whole concept of love. Of course, it's a lot easier when you believe in God, but, to go beyond just your neighbor, but include Soviets as your neighbors and the homeless as your neighbors, including your people. But just that one idea.
But I'm talking about other Christians you would talk to.
Well, in response to that, from looking at it from more from the other side, an appeal to love your neighbor wouldn't go very far. It's not. It's nice, and it's good, but I don't think it would go very far in arguing or in trying to present. An argument for the peace movement.
With other Christians?
Yeah. Just as love is kind of an intangible, warm, fuzzy thing. That's not going to fly. This week, I think what is going to be things like, what would Jesus do with it? That's what I'm working on now. That's what I'm trying to figure out.
Yeah, I misunderstood. I thought that if you were talking to someone who's not a Christian, I thought that would be the question.
No, it's someone who is a Christian.
But thinks differently. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, but I would think that a big part of it would be whom do you believe? Credible sources. I mean, when you can quote the Joint Chiefs of Staff, then I think that's more effective than just saying, well, this Peace magazine says such and such. I mean, you have to kind of appeal to facts that are there that aren't opinions. I think for a lot of Americans, it's just not being confronted with the reality. But getting such a line all the time.
My understanding is that from what little I know about the beginning of the early stages of nuclear weapons, is that they were developed as means of warfare. And what that says to me is what's more important than technically how to handle bombs and other weapons that we have is how we go about the whole problem of war in the world. And it's like it's even more important.
It's about a couple of kids of ambassadors. One's ambassador of the Soviet Union, and a couple of kids, anyhow, Soviet kid and American kid.
Minnesota schools.
Yeah, they finally get the President of the United States and the President of the Soviet Union to get together over a vodka and to sit down and talk about stuff. And somewhere in there, there's a line that says the problem isn't nuclear weapons. The problem is what goes on inside people's heads that makes them feel they need to have the weapons. And certainly, nuclear disarmament is treating a symptom of fear and of a lot of things, power, need for power. That made me think, really, I just wanted to use this new marker, it's so fun. The article, or the section in the book on civilian-based defense, and in talking about it, I find people get really excited when you give them some sort of alternatives, you know, that we just don't, we can't imagine any alternative that might possibly work, because there are not many of us that want to roll over and, you know, give up our way of life, both good and bad aspects of that, and to talk about some alternatives for many people is really, really exciting. And especially when you can give some historical examples, though there aren't hundreds, there are dozens. And I've found that to be real helpful. Especially when you talk to, you know, a couple that worked against Nazism. And had we, you know, it's exciting for me to imagine, and here we're entirely in the area of imagination, but had we put in 20% of the money and 40% of the effort into civilian-based defense against Hitler, you know, how effective would that have been? How quickly, how many people would have died? What would have been the effect? You know, we don't know, but we certainly paid a big price. Remember in the movie Gandhi, the beginning of World War II, Gandhi is asked, you know, would your methods work? And he said something like, well, I don't know. There would be lots of suffering and death, but your way there will be lots of suffering and death also. He certainly, you know, was right about that.
I just keep thinking that there's really two different kinds of populations you are thinking about. Those who know so little, or perhaps just, I suppose you could classify it under education, can be very meaningful. They just haven't ever thought about it, you know, they just put it off, haven't really confronted the issues. And those who have really dealt with it, but have reached a different conclusion than you. I mean, it would be a very different approach too, I would think. Mm-hmm. But I was thinking, certainly there are ways of people learning to understand the issues. All we have to do is consider ourselves. We all came to it somehow, especially those of us who are not just recent college graduates and so on. We, somewhere along the line, have changed and learned and so on. Mm-hmm. And just if you just think how you yourself came to at least be cognizant of it all and so on, and have some clue too, it's too helpful.
I've given away several copies of that green book, The Race to Nowhere, and several copies of The New Testament Basis of Peacemaking, also to people, and you know, I don't know how much effect that has or what, but I like those because they're cheap, and they're, you know, quickly read and have green one has pictures and things like that, and it's easy to get some handles.
What are they again?
Well, the Race to Nowhere, an arms race primer for Catholics.
Yeah, I just looked at that this morning.
These are all in the bookstore on the table now. And then that little, I don't think I brought it today, New Testament Basis of Peacemaking by Richard McSorley.
It's on reserve, isn't it?
Yeah, they're both on reserve in there as well. But especially if we're dealing with Christian, well, yeah, that's the green one right there. Okay, anything else? Wait, 10 minutes if you want to use it for last minute. Questions, comments, suggestions? One thing I have to remember is that I've been at this for a long time. I want people in about an hour, hour and a half, you know, to be where I am. Okay, Bill. Relax.
At home, after a while, I always had the pot up the night of the meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, mopping grass and trying to stuff like that.
Oh,
One of the hardest things, and I think it's a group practicing together, is that how, as you're trying to teach peace, how do we relate peacefully to people that disagree with us?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, that's hard. When I've been out speaking and have some angry person pushing me up against the wall, my impulse is to lash back. How can we embrace this? Ron Sider, I think, is my model for that. He's coming this summer, and he also was here a couple summers ago teaching peace. And when you get hostile responses, he had a way of just reaching out and embracing this person, making them feel worthy, at the same time not agreeing with them. Time I want to listen to all of his tapes to try to learn more how he does that.
It seems to me, though, that when you do that, you have to really believe that you care about that person, or then it's just a manipulation that's upon you.
Yeah.
When somebody reaches out to me and tries to embrace me, just simply shut me up, I am going to be get more angry than I was when I started.
Yeah, I would say too.
I don't trust that kind. I don't really trust that kind.
And that's one of the principles of nonviolence that you have. When you say you love a person, you have to do it. It's not a technique, or it's not. So it is a technique, but it's a.
Yeah. I think it's helpful just to admit that we don't love everybody. And when somebody disagrees on something that, for example, you give your whole life to a condition of peace. You've got people who don't agree with you. The reality is you agree with them, don't like them very much. Mm-hmm. And to be able to live with that and to work through that, I think, is a beginning.
Yeah.
As opposed to saying, the Bible tells me I have to love everybody, even those who disagree, even those who are my enemies. I don't think we do that very well. So maybe can we ask for ourselves and say, I don't do that very well. I don't like you because of where you are. Maybe we can work on it.
There were four people in the congregation that were most vocally in opposition to some of the things that we were trying to do with the peacemaking committee. And two of them I really got to be real close to working through things, and two of them we just kind of said, let's just stay out of each other's way because we give each other so much pain. We just, especially I gave them pain because I was in the position of power as pastor. But I've mentioned this to some of you. Probably my single most embarrassing moment in my life, and I've had lots of them, given the nature of who I am, was the first time in the congregation that I was teaching a class called Introduction to the Arms Race or something. And in 9 weeks, we covered the gamut. Each week was for an hour, we covered something else. Arms Race from a Soviet Perspective, one week, and the Just War Theory, 1 week, and all this stuff. And 1 week on Civilian-Based Defense, Nonviolent Resistance, which was really, this was back in like 78, and it was really new to people. And it was the first time I had tried to walk my way through it, and I did a really poor job. And I finally get done, and I'm feeling a lot of emotion too, feeling really alone at this time. It's before a peacemaking committee. It's about the seventh week of this class, and 50 people out there, and most of them pretty hostile. And the end of the time, I said, well, any response to this? And this guy says, but nonviolent resistance isn't going to work. I mean, look at the Jews in Germany in World War II. And I took my pencil and said, the Jews in Germany didn't do a damn thing in World War II. And I went, I'm so embarrassed. I'm really, really sorry. I'm really, really apologizing. But it was just, I had so much anger. And then we had worship right after that. And my children's sermon, he planned ahead of time, was about James and John, the disciples, the sons of thunder, who wanted to call down lightning on this unbelieving town. So I'm telling this story, and I kind of look up, I look around, and the 50 people who are in the class are all just laughing their heads off. And the other 200 people are going, but that was so. So he called me up when I got home, and we went ice fishing together that afternoon. We're good friends, but boy, was that. I'll never forget that.
But I think humility is a part of this too, to recognize that we err and let the other people know that we don't have all the answers. Maybe you accomplished more by that than.
Well, ultimately, I think it did. We did. And Dick and I talked about it, and he said, we didn't plan it this way, but we're really onto something now. So we've got people's attention. and so that was kind of fun, and he's just a really lovely person. And